We gather gratefully on the land of Treaty One today in this part of the world. If you're watching from or listening from somewhere else, I would encourage you, if you are not, to make yourself aware of the nature of the land on which you live and move and have your being, and on which you are part of this particular community's engagement. Those of us here in Manitoba, in the south of Manitoba, are on Treaty One land. Land which has been stewarded from well before what Europeans thought of as history by the first peoples, the indigenous peoples of this continent, and whose work in tending to that land we all enjoy the fruits of, despite many things that have been part of the colonizing process that have literally uprooted some of that stewardship. And you know, burned it in the ditch, only to discover that even in fire, seeds survive. Well, welcome to today's Talky Bit. Last week we went on a wee side trip for Thanksgiving, which I barely managed to overtly connect to the topic of this series, which is the pursuit of happiness. And it's kind of amusing to me that it felt like such a tag-on, but there's a reason why, from my perspective at least. It's because when I really got rolling last week on the history of the event that we call Thanksgiving, I ended up in a space that I find thoroughly occupying, which is the space of exploring the ways in which the dominant narratives in this part of the world are slowly but surely being reconsidered. And this time, I hope, without the same kind of commitment to erasure of their fuller truth that often stands solidly within the history of the indigenous peoples of this continent. Thanksgiving, just in case you missed last week, is no exception. And if you weren't able to connect in person last week, you can check out the podcast on our website, tablewinnipeg.com. All to say, I got so occupied with the intricacies of that story that I never got to something that I had researched a bit and that I had notes on, but that I didn't have time for. And that's the relationship between expressing thanks, which is often equated with or named as gratitude these days, and happiness. And that connection is pretty unambiguous. That's not an especially murky connection in terms of what we know from the research. Choosing gratitude, expressing gratitude, contributes to our overall experience tilting toward happiness. It's not magic. In fact, sometimes it is rather difficult work. But it does, in fact, work. And we'll get into some of those studies as we go along. Not in this talky bit, but in some of the ones to come. Today, though, I want to explore a question that feels like it has both personal roots and, I would say, broader cultural and religious ones. And I know I've said this before, I've been explicit about it, we've explored it in some detail, but just to restate it simply, my perspective on religion is that it is a cultural artifact, that it doesn't actually live in a category that's separate from the other things that we make that we would call culture, that it's a cultural linguistic construct. We make it out of the raw materials around us in our human lived experience, and we use language to express its parameters and its shape. So if I do distinguish it, it's as a particular sort of subcategory of culture, not some other category that is walled off from that kind of examination or change or evolution or challenge. All to say, I want to explore a question that feels like it has both personal roots and religious roots. And the simplest way that I can think of to phrase the question I want to explore this morning is, why might I or anyone feel guilty about feeling happy? Put it another way, why might we feel as though we need to make excuses for our happiness? Now, that's a personal question for me because I sometimes have those experiences. I have particular memories, especially from what the period that, you know, we define as adolescence, of being chastised for being too happy in certain settings. I think those dressings down might have worked. I haven't been accused of that for quite some time. On the religious side of things, we touched on this a bit early on in the series. I can remember this moment from our in-person gatherings early in this series. We were in an in-person gathering. I made some comment about people being taught in their religious settings growing up that happiness was some kind of categoric problem, and just sort of said a couple of things about how there seemed to be in many of those settings this parsing thing that happened, so that somehow joy was okay, but it's what? It's lesser relative, it's distant cousin happiness was not okay. So what's that all about? I don't think the stereotype of the dour, you know, I'm working hard on being holy person comes from nowhere. And as I was talking about that, I looked out in the room and there were people kind of going, mm-hmm, yep, me too, you know? And I thought, well, okay, this was not a unique experience to me. Why does feeling happy, why does expressing happiness, encouraging it, get such a rough ride in some settings? I suppose the answer depends in no small part on the setting, right? I mean, there are occasions where it would just be bad form to be giddy with happiness. Maybe it's just my recent experience, but I instantly think that such an expression would be immediately suspect at funerals, at least at the official gatherings. At wakes or celebrations of life, or whatever we want to call them, not so much. But in sort of the church version, as I've experienced them predominantly, yeah, yeah. And maybe in the experience of some of us, church in general wasn't a place to really, you know, let your happy horses out for a run. And we've talked about that in this space as well, especially as it has history with what is still often referred to as the Puritan work ethic and the impact of all of that on North American Christianity. There's a podcast of a talky bit about that whole topic somewhere in the archives. Can't remember where. Also, and I'm not trying to demonstrate a causal relationship here, being openly happy at classical music events can be a problem. Oh my goodness. A friend of ours, and I realize this is there's a terribly privileged window I'm looking through with this whole illustration. Friend of ours, someone whose kids were all heavily involved in classical music growing up, told us a very funny story about this recently that I want to pass along in this context. It was the closing concert of a summer classical music camp, and one of her son's friends, her kids had been involved in it, and one of her son's friends had realized at the last minute that he didn't have any of the required black pants that he needed for the closing performance of this event. And because our friend had a kid about the same age and size, he contacted her to ask if he could borrow some of her son's pants. And these families kind of live next door to one another, but it's sort of out in the country. You don't lock the door when you leave. And people were already starting to gather at the concert hall. So our friend just told this kid where to find the pants in their house. He said he had done so, and everyone was sort of off to the concert. Timelines were tight. If you're wondering how this story might be relevant, just stay with me. We'll get there. So when the kid who had borrowed the pants walked out on the stage to perform his solo violin piece, our friend and this kid's mom were sitting together, and it only took one look at this kid to realize that he had either somehow misunderstood the directions or taken a wrong turn in the house, because instead of our friend's son's pants, he was wearing their daughter's pants. Now, all the parties involved were about the same height, so the clue wasn't that the pants were too short. They were a few other too much things. They were too tight by a fair bit, stretchy, too shiny, too high-waisted. I mean, use your imaginations. And add to that a pretty flamboyant sort of hold your violin high and deliver style of performance, and you might be able to understand why both the parents, when this kid walked out on the stage, they just got a really serious case of the giggles. And they couldn't stop. And they couldn't stop when the performance was over, that particular song. They just kept going despite the increasing number of people that were glaring at them and shushing them and, you know, so on. Now, I don't want to lose you for the balance of the talky bit, but if you grew up around religion, take yourself back and see if you can think of any equivalent moments in church. In some traditions, you know, doing the things that we might do when we're truly effusively happy, like jumping around or waving our hands in the air or shouting, that might all be okay. That might even be encouraged or expected when the band is rocking or if the preacher is kind of really whipping the crowd into a frenzy. But unless it's, you know, big air quotes, unless it's holy laughter, like, don't get the giggles. Not okay. Again, what's that about? Well, I want to make some suggestions. I want to explore this a bit. These are not one size fits all. My hope is that they might serve to get us moving, to get us thinking about our own stories and what sorts of things we've been taught that could get in the way of our unabashed, utterly unapologetic pleasure and delight in being happy. Before we get more specific, I should say something about why I believe that this matters. Sort of two aspects of this that I want to comment on. The first is that I want to thank a particular author for being so catalytic for me on this topic. I heard an interview a couple of months ago with a young writer named Joy Marie Clarkson, who has written a book called Aggressively Happy. If you do have occasion to look it up, the title comes from an ironic experience, I suppose you could say. And that interview and book have been and continue to be instrumental in provoking me to keep exploring the topic and giving me sort of outline prompts for exploring it in our context. So I wanted to acknowledge that and to say thank you, Joy Marie Clarkson. And the second matter is to address the question, why do I think happiness matters enough to spend time and energy, not just mine, but ours, exploring the topic? Because some would dismiss this as trivial or misleading or problematic, like just by title. You know, judge the book by the title and be done. Like a lot of things that I believe, I'm not sure that I could prove any of this, but it does seem reasonable. What if the emotional and spiritual muscles we use to thoroughly and wholeheartedly enjoy innocent pleasures are the same ones that we use to do things like forming deep friendships, or that we use to believe in good things, or that we use to say and mean it, that being alive feels to us like a good thing? What if the sort of the human oomph that it takes to do those kinds of things is strengthened by, I would say simply, but it feels like a misstatement, by being unapologetically happy? And again, as we said at the beginning of the series, the volume of happiness and the placement of it matters. We're not talking about something that is always on 11 in every setting all the time. That's toxic happiness. That's a problem. But when it is in its place, why would we step back from that? What if enjoying things unironically, Clarkson's word, my spell checker doesn't believe it exists, but I like it. What if enjoying things unironically could be our small act of resistance to the things about our modern world that make it hard to be human beings fully alive, which the late 2nd century theologian Irenaeus of Lyons suggested was one of the best shortcuts to seeing what he called the glory of God? I don't share very many perspectives with that particular theologian, but I do find some resonance with that one. What if happiness, what if really, you know, leaning into it, happiness could be like a window that gives us a glimpse of what is usually experienced as beyond us? What if it's a spiritual path? How about that? Does that not sound like about as pleasant a path toward a more lively spirituality and a better world as could be imagined? Does it sound too pleasant, perhaps? Does it sound pleasant enough to make us suspicious of its validity or its moral integrity or its spiritual integrity? Well, as always, you have to be the judge for yourself, but while I've got your, you know, attention in some way, I'm gonna offer some suggestions about those questions. The genesis of this is not original with me, but I've found these ideas worth exploring, and so I'm going to share them. And just a reminder, because we've been traveling alongside some of these ideas a little bit in the last few minutes, these are some possible reasons that we might pull back from enjoying life and admitting that we're enjoying it, that things that might prompt us to couch our admissions of enjoyment in frames like embarrassment or irony, and remind us to make sure that we shouldn't enjoy them too much or too often. So these are questions, or reasons rather, that address why we might behave that way. A starting point. One of the I think recurring and big reasons why we might back off from unironic happiness, just full-on happiness, is because we might be afraid of what other people think of us. Might as well start with a biggie, right? That fear, what other people might think of us, that is full of what I would call moving cultural and contextual targets. And we might be afraid to admit that we like some aspect or artifact of pop culture because we don't want to appear silly or uncultured or vacuous or just, you know, full blast weird. If what we like, and sort of staying in that popular culture context, what if what we like pushes the boundaries of propriety by someone's standards? We might be concerned that somebody's going to think that we're uncouth or that, you know, we dropped our moral compass and lost it in the quagmire of our pop culture preferences somewhere. And religious rules often take this propensity, this, I think, shared human experience, and they run it on 11. They just turn the volume all the way up on it. Sometimes it really does seem to me like there's an inverse relationship between a religion's notions about the divine and how many rules they have for how we need to behave. And that the equation, if there was one, would run something like smaller ideas about the divine equals more rules about behavior. It wouldn't do to test grace now, would it? In Christian theology, this thorny dilemma has been around from the beginning of the tradition, as far as we can tell. I can hear the voice, having grown up in that tradition, I can hear the voice of the Apostle Paul in my head, "Shall we sin that grace may abound? May it never be so." And whenever I read Paul's writings, I find myself thinking, you really should read a Brené Brown book, you know, and address some of your shame issues. Which might be more relevant than it first sounds, you know, that could just sound dismissive and sort of flippant. But given the outsized influence of the Apostle Paul's writings on what is still numerically the largest religion on the planet and a religion that has had such profound influence on the cultural shapes generated by European culture, broadly speaking, that's not a crazy idea that there's some troubleshooting to be done there as regards ideas based in what we would maybe in the 21st century West call shame. And in a curious twist that doesn't reflect the reality of the world at all, we might be afraid that if our guilty pleasure, you know, as opposed to pop culture, our guilty pleasure is Bach, who wrote literally hundreds of pieces of religious music, we might be thought of as too uppity or snobbish. It's like you can't win on this one. So whichever way our enjoyment takes us, we'll find someone who regards our taste, our morality, our intelligence as suspect. Can't please all the people, you know? Why does this matter so much to us as human beings? Because I would say that in my observation, with moments of exception, it really does matter to us, doesn't it? Well, one lens on this is to suggest that at its root, we could say that it matters so much to us because we're beings that thrive in relationship and community. We're herd animals. We need one another. It's a primal reality that has been drummed into us for as long as we've been around. We need others as a matter of survival, because if no one likes me, who's going to provide for me? Who's going to protect me? Who's going to help me up if I fall down? It's a trail that I won't go far down today, but I think it's important to not pin that idea too tightly to the notion that we humans are unique when it comes to our need to be interdependent. It is not necessarily a sign of civilization that we help one another. It may be a sign of something more fundamental even than world making. And the living world is full of examples of this from the places where we might expect to see it as humans. So we do see this kind of need for interdependence expressed in the behavior of primates, you know, our close cousins. But we also see it in places that are less visible and obvious, such as the interdependent behavior of trees. And if we get this notion out of whack, I think we're vulnerable to disconnecting our actions, even those that we might construe as caring for one another, as having nothing to do with our environment, that they're somehow only human. We are unique as human beings in some truly wondrous ways, and we've also done more damage to the planet than any other species that inhabits it. And so there's a bit of a balance to be explored there, I think, a bit of attention to be explored. All to say, while our need for one another may not be unique in the living world, it is powerful. And not just sort of at that bottom of the pyramid level of survival. It's powerful there, but it's powerful further up that particular model as well. We are social animals, among other things. And it's in the constant observation of the approval or disapproval of others that we tend to determine the meaning of our actions and the worth of our lives. We tend to measure who we are based on the feedback we get from others. And that's sort of a well-demonstrated fact about being human. We are deeply oriented as humans to relationship and union, and anything that threatens that can feel enormous. We are so afraid of isolation that we will go to considerable lengths to prevent it or to avert whatever or whomever we perceive as a threat to it. And this is, by the way, I think, one lens that can help make sense of some of the range of reactions that we see people demonstrate to things like lockdowns during the pandemic. In that instance, a pivotal issue is how one perceives the reason for and the hoped outcomes of a thing like a lockdown. So to just draw it too starkly, but to illustrate it, are we staying apart? Are we locked down so that we can carry on together? So to make that more likely that it'll happen? Or are we locked down for some reason that's more nefarious, that has some other agenda, for example? So all to say, this stuff is powerful. And we will adjust our enjoyments, we will deny our personalities, we will reshape ourselves into folks that won't rock the boat, all so that we can be accepted and have an experience of belonging. Now, all of that sort of taken together in the moment might make it sound like it's a bad thing to care about what other people think about us. And that's not the case, of course. Caring about what other people think can be a source of significant and considerable growth in our lives. I can definitely think of things that are in my life and that make it better that I would never have thought to pursue were it not for the fact that someone else, someone whose opinion I respected or cared about or wanted to have like me, you know, wanted to have care about me, something that they liked. And that pointed me in the direction of those things. And to me, I can easily think of this, especially when it comes to music. I can still remember exactly where I was the first time a friend played me a Whitney Houston album, and I heard that voice, a Lee Ritenour album, and I heard the brand of music that is sort of LA fusion of rock and funk and jazz. And I mean, I could go on. In so many ways, my life has been made better because I wanted to, in some ways, be like someone that I admired. So I checked out the things they were on about, and my intellect and my enjoyment of life, my happiness, grew as a result. I can still feel happier just thinking about a particular song off the first album by that guitarist Lee Ritenour that I heard, like in this moment. This is powerful. But it's the darker side of this that most of us are more familiar with. And this is kind of psych 101, you know, where we might have encountered the idea that we have a tendency to enact the very things that we fear, sort of the self-fulfilling prophecies. When it comes to our desire to be accepted, we might put a damper on who we are and what we enjoy to avoid rejection. So far, sort of so logical, if you will. But when we do that, we can end up actualizing the very thing that we're trying to avoid. If we suppress who we are in order to be accepted, it just might work. And if it does, we might end up accepted by a group of people with whom we have very little in common and who don't actually know us as ourselves. We can end up accepted but not authentically known. And that can be a more confounding sort of isolation than being honestly who we are and lonely, because it can end up with us being surrounded by people who might even say they like us, and we might even say we like them, and there might be aspects of truth to that, but who don't know us. So who are they really liking? They're liking a charade, they're liking a shadow, a facsimile, but not an authentic person. So we've got this problem. We want to be known, but we also want to be accepted, and there's a little, or maybe a not so little, voice inside of us that says, you can't have it both ways. C.S. Lewis, in his book, The Four Loves, makes this observation. Friendship must be about something. Even if it were only an enthusiasm for dominoes or white mice. I read the quote and I'm like, why did you pick those? Anyway, he goes on to say this. Those who have nothing can share nothing. Those who are going nowhere can have no fellow travelers. Now, to my way of thinking, both the logic and the rhetoric of that ring true, although I think there's an important and increasingly common scenario in our time that sort of leaves to the side, the way lots of pithy thinking and writing does. Having nothing and going nowhere, phrases that Lewis uses in that quote, might actually characterize the way that quite a lot of people feel. They might, in fact, find company and even something we would call friendship with others who feel the same. And there's a reason why there was and may still be, I don't know, because I kind of don't dip into this that often, more that this more came to me. But there's a reason why there was and there might still be groups of people feeling that way, like they have nothing and they're going nowhere, who find other people online and get together in an organized way to end their lives by suicide together. That's such a grim story. I can only think at the moment of one positive takeaway from it in this context. And this might be a failure of imagination on my part. Feel free to help me out. But what comes to mind after I face the great sadness that story evokes for me is the thought that our need for one another is just that powerful. It's just that necessary. Even if all we have to share is despair and nihilism, we look for a way to share it. We have a built-in human drive to find a way to share that. How much better would it be to look around our lives, even if we're looking in the closets or the darkest corners of the basement, to find something, almost anything, that sparks even the tiniest bit of authentic enjoyment, of pleasure, of happiness, and see if we can somehow share that with someone else. Enjoyment, happiness, even in the smallest or seemingly least meaningful things, dominoes and white mice might come to mind, gives us something for our friendships to be about other than our own bottomless and sometimes completely baffling need for connection. It reorients us to sharing, to othering in a good way, to connecting with one another. We might find it easier to be our most generous and delightful selves when we're on about something we love, whether it's, you know, the defunct space cowboy narratives of Firefly or macrame or craft beer or experimental jazz. By the way, that's not an exhaustive or necessarily personal list. Then when we're bending ourselves out of our own authentic shape to try to be liked by someone. And our connections with others will be much more profound and direct if they're based on honest self-disclosure of what we love in life than if they're a carefully curated image that we present in order to gain approval. So, maybe this is a place to start. Admitting our enjoyments and pleasures in life might seem like a small thing. But like other things that sound small, it can be quite a challenge to do. And yet, even a small step in this direction is a step away from trying to build happiness on the fragile footing of other people's opinions about us. Unabashedly, unironically liking something, and even admitting we like it, is practice. It's us taking a run at vulnerability. And vulnerability invites connection. Perhaps the reason that religion gets hung up on this as often and in some of the ways that it does is because, at least in the religious traditions that I grew up in, there's this notion about the divine that carries with it sort of a preemptive judgment. This is founded in lots of different aspects of common traditional notions of the divine. But one biggie in Christian tradition would be an idea like you know, that we're sinful, that we're fallen. So we're prejudged. We're prejudged as not acceptable by that theological notion. When you start there, and never mind if you're still in patriarchal sort of pictures of this where God is, you know, a father, Can't even tell you how many conversations I've had with people who have father images and for whom, or father struggles rather, and for whom their images and experiences of fathering have been so awful that any religious notion that suggests that that which we do not see with clarity, that which is mystery to us, might be like a cosmic father, that's enough to shut the whole conversation down right there. So some of those notions, I think, can get in the way in the early going if we're brought up in those contexts. And they're hard ones to shake. They're hard to step to the side of and go, wait a minute, what if I didn't start there? What if I started with a completely different notion about what it means to be a human being, a spiritual human being? Would I then be able to begin to imagine in happiness a window that opens into mystery? That's like a, if you're familiar with iconography at all, that's like an icon. That's like an object which is itself not the end goal, but rather a thing. It's reified, it's physical to us, it's real to us, it's that we can experience it, through which we might move deeper into that which is not a thing, that which is mystery and spirit. What if happiness was like that? And what if the way in which we got to test that idea and explore it was in and out of and around this need that we have for connection with one another? All to say, I'm going to offer you an experiment for this week, should you choose to accept it. And not just for this week, but I mean, because we talk about these things with certain rhythm, let me say for this week. Here it is. Modify as you wish, but catalyst, right? Think of something that you genuinely like and enjoy, something that makes you happy. Don't prejudge it. Just, if you think of it as a guilty pleasure in some realms or in some relational contexts, or think somebody else might think you should think it's a guilty pleasure, don't let that stop you. Just think of something that you genuinely like and enjoy and that makes you happy, okay? Start there. Now try to think of someone that you want to tell about it. Someone that you want to share that happiness with. And just go, I love this. This just makes me grin. It makes me smile. It makes me happy. Think of somebody that you want to tell about it and then do it. Now, even just imagining that, depending what you're thinking about, might be enough to give you chills. I don't know. Maybe it starts to make you smile already. But just to put it on the table, could this backfire? Yes. I appreciated so much, Cheryl, and the pre-talky bit part of our time together, you talking about how some things are hard and just acknowledging that, just naming that. This is tough. That's tough. That's a tough thing to go through. Could this backfire? Yes. We need to acknowledge that. That's one of the reasons, or not reasons, but rather one of the ways in which we do the process of going, thinking through if we're going to do it or not, right? So yes, it could backfire. We could share that thing and somebody might look at us like we've just kind of grown a third eye in the middle of our forehead. They might react negatively. They might be indifferent, which can even feel worse because then we don't know where we stand. But what if the opposite or something like the opposite happens? What if we share something that makes us happy with another person and they're like, seriously? You too? I thought I was the only one, or, you know, part of such a small select group that I might never meet another person. And sometimes we have to use our imaginations in these exercises, right? Even in our relational expressing of them, we have to be willing to kind of both speak about these things that make us happy in ways that are particular to us and our experience. We can name certain things like I just did with, you know, with some movies and some music. But we also know that those things represent categories, right? They represent realms of experience and ideas. And sometimes the connection when we're sharing or when we're listening to somebody share needs to be bigger than just, oh, I've never heard of that artist. I've never read that book, that author. I've never seen any movies by that director or listened to music by that composer or whatever we're talking about. Not the point. The point is that those things sit in a category. And so if we listen with curiosity and imagination and we share hoping that we will meet those same things, so we're watching for them, we might discover that the pool of people whose happiness is connected to things that also make us happy is bigger than we thought. And there can be some progress to be made. We might, in taking a risk like that, just make a friend. And that, my friends, just might make us more happy, more fully alive, closer to, more able to look through the window of happiness and see the mystery that is beyond that. Yeah, maybe. I leave it with you to think about and say peace to you in your explorations. It's been good to be with you.